very happy to have Don and Michael here tonight. They're both great friends of the Gloucester Writer Center, and it's been great to hear, to just have them be part of us, a great part of our community. You'll have to excuse me if my introductions are lackluster. I'm under the weather. Don Wellman is a poet and translator. As editor of Oars, he produced a series of annual anthologies, including Coherence and Translations, Experiments in Reading. He has translated books of poetry by Antonio Gomoneda, Emilio Prados, Yvonne Goll, and Roberto Echevarrian. I'm going to do horribly at this tonight. I'm sorry. His expressivity in modern poetry is forthcoming from Farleigh Dickinson University Press. His poetry has been described as transcultural and Baroque. His collections include Roman Exercises, the Cranberry Island series, A North Atlantic Wall, Prologue Pages, and Fields. His most recent publication is Albiac Ceylon, Readings Across Languages. And tonight he'll be reading from his translations of the work of Roberto Echevarrian and Nestor, I can't even prolong her. Am I close? I'm sorry. Both crucial poets with respect to the development of experimental or neo-Baroque poetry from Latin America. Very excited to have Don here tonight. And thank you very much.
Okay. I might not fully live up to that billing, but we'll see. The book I want to promote, although it may be rude, is Albiac Ceylon, Reading Across Languages. And it's just such a beautiful book. That's the best thing. No, it's not the best thing about it. And in it, I give a very close reading of everything that Derrida said about Ceylon, plus my own Ceylon material and my own theories of translation. And you get little snippets of work that I've done. And the editor, publisher, was totally in love with Anne-Marie Albiac, whom he felt to be the greatest French poet of the 20th century. She's in the school over there they call Écriture. She's responsible for translating people like Zhukovsky and Creeley, who are part of the family, as it were, into French. And I had the honor of being able to translate a poem of hers that has not previously been published except on a website in France. And I'll just read a little bit of the French. Après cela, moi, j'ai regardé. Une mémoire atemporel s'annule et croit dans ces fragments allusifs qu'une logique ignorée unit. Desire apprehends these fragments juxtaposed where fear, the apprehension and interlacing of the real and with these rapid images, sudden, fleeting, the drive that plays with destruction and from its destruction, points of precise memory, their behavior in an evolving context of fiction, mask, double, in perspective, asymptote, the body projects itself, divides, memorizes, a fervor, bodily, grammatical, an onanism of the letter engenders itself. Projection. The air irradiated, mouth closed. Chance like fiction, the stake. Chance as logic, the enigma. So you may realize that the end of this is a kind of tribute to Mallarmé on Coup de Dé, then this discussion of chance and all that. I chose to read this beginning in both languages because of this concept, grammatical, an onanism of the letter. And this is really a squeezing and a milking of the letter and the word. And I think that's what a translator has to do. There is another essay in here by another Écriture poet named Jean Dive, and he discusses in great detail Anne-Marie's method. What I present tonight is dedicated to my love and memory of Charlie Shively, a gay poet who just recently passed 3 or 4 days ago. In one of the more interesting summations of his life that appeared recently, the author, I think his name is Michael Bronsky, who teaches at Harvard sexuality studies there, wrote that Charlie was not about the kind of politics or feelings or identities that most move many gay people today, especially young people in the struggle for equality. And God knows we're all for that struggle for equality, gay marriage, and in this time with so much prejudice. But Charlie was an anarchist. Charlie was about liberation. He was about liberation of human sexuality in all of its forms, both sexes, ages, no boundaries with his anarchy. He was about liberation. And living in a world without that degree of personal liberation, maybe it's impossible, creates huge anxieties and depressions in me. And that's part of what my essay poems are about, and I'll read some of those in just a minute. My other project is, there are two or three books here. We have 4 books of my collaboration with Roberto Echavarren, who is probably my age and also the leading gay Uruguayan poet who taught also at NYU for 30 years. And this is just a stunning friendship we've had, where I've now translated 4 of his books in less than a year. These books are about what is called the neo-barocco, or the new baroque style of poetry in Latin America. Maybe it started with Borges. I didn't even bring an example up here. Could you? I do plan to read just a little bit from this book. It's called The Virgin Mountain. This is the most recent. It's a thing about onanism of the word. The Spanish is el monte nativo, but we can't say native in American English anymore. So what does one mean by a mountain that has native properties? After much thought, I came up with virgin, as though it were untouched. But I'm not sure that's really the best answer. I'll read a few words. The thing about the neo-barocco is that it's all of these very sinuous, long sentences. I just read the English. Each is an island universe where it all happens. Storms and rivers, water spouts and jets, the song of meteors. Each has its own world, its rivalries and honors, rolled in a spiral, turbulent and wild. Cyclones escape everywhere. Sea flaps shaking up each turbulence brings suffering and danger. Doesn't matter how small, the gradual uprising of the wheel at each turn produces a spiral, a horsetail of fluxes, dismemberment and destruction. Time is the interruption of repose. Everything is part of a perpetual flow, rays of light penetrate a dense conjunction of aggregates. We are a mask of flesh plaster, defaced by a spurt of water. However, bad faith must not be tolerated. It hardens the heart of men. Anger must go out through the open window. So please don't swallow it up because it hurts the liver. In the surf, cutting the heads of transparent mackerels, anger dissolves itself. I pass through a tunnel among thorns of the cross and entered a clearing in the Virgin Mountain. It's full of guinea pigs. I stop there without knowing why. Sheltered from the wind by trees, under a folding screen of clouds, my upper lip swollen by a bee sting. It's early morning. I hear distant barking, suffocated by the thickness of the gas. A horse parades before me, like a string theory demonstration, a trotting theorem. Its hooves resound as they hit rocks and flint stones. It shakes its head without a halter and seems about to neigh when its blue-beard tail, lightly asunder from its root, bared its rear and discovered a small, bouncing anus, hermetically closed, unfolding at its center. It suddenly turned as a glove, and the pink, humid corolla gushed new, varnished balls of dung that rolled through the breakers. I just had to combine this. This is crazy combination of philosophy and visceral poetry. I find it quite inspirational. Well, there will be four of his books available soon. So this is from Essay Poems. Essay Poems, as in the Echevarena, just take out philosophical themes, but turn it in raw and sacred directions. I'm going to talk about a few poets who influenced me in the poem. One is Emilio Prados, a poet who was once a lover, we think, of Garcia Lorca, but died as the loneliest man in the world. Another is Antonio Gamoneda, a prize-winning poet in Spain who I believe was beaten by the Augustinian monks as a boy. Quick references that you'll probably understand to Gerald Manley Hopkins and a few others. So I'm going to read a poem which is like an essay, although it's written in five-line stanzas. The Lives of the Poets. My beloved Emilio did not study with Husserl, he says. He was a student in Freiburg then. Instead, he courted solitude and dreamed of the boy who inspired him to study animal husbandry. Entre Cañones, Antonio perished in the battle for Madrid. My grim Antonio of another age learned his Latin from Augustinians who employed corporal punishment for wayward boys. The donkey steamed when the soldier bashed in its brains. Now, in his old age, his daughter and his granddaughter comfort him. The nun with the concertina regaled the girls who skipped rope in the alley. In those days, the sexes did not mix during recess. The boys gambled with marbles or threw pennies against a wall, the poets' glasses like saucers. Donald loved languages. Gerald, who wrote in sprung rhythm. Donald venerated James, who skulked behind statues and fingered the anus of Venus, silver apples of the moon. He lived in a garage with an earthen floor. The linoleum reeked of axle grease and horse manure. Among his books were Rabelais and Adolescence. He had walked along the Rhone where mustard bloomed. He knew a Russian song about the margin of the sea. His Rimbaud revelry befell upon a Neckar River barge. He saw the Camargue with his adolescent daughter. They slept in the cloister, gnawed by usure, San Trofime, orange soda in the night cafe, Ireland and Spain, long after inspiration had bent his bones into walking canes. Grim, his love for solitude prepared him for eternity. Clichés, like milkweed, float among embroideries. It's not a poem about a crumb of dust, as Edward Taylor wrote, but of triumph for all its jags and jars. In the windy blue Canadian air, he climbed to the rooftop and swept old carbon from the chimney flue. Herman Melville suspends philosopher's skulls from the yardarm of his Pequod. Stateless anime, my fisher king, not the seaport polis where poets' children thrive in a park above harbor tides, in Australian desert, maternal men celebrate fatherhood. Bob Allen John. After the loss of his eye, his family moved to West Acton, where the train to Fitchburg paused. My grandmother took me to the eye and ear on the Nashua line, a Woolworth's in Scolly Square, brilliant with plastic airplanes, French toast slathered with chemical syrup. John, do you remember Harvard Gardens in Mystical 55? Stephen and Robin and Jack, no one listens to poetry. I'm just back from the home on Dana Street, where Charlie, who always wore farmer's jeans, waits for Mitzel. In the parking lot, old men smoke salvaged butt ends. A poetry collective is a tender memory. We met on Bromfield Street. We met in Christiansted and in the afterlife on the north shore of Haiti. Bombs where poets gathered, Baghdad and Boston. Headlines in El País, Rent Boys That Lonely Summer. Spain, like New England, where lives are never as they seem to those who seek the genuine article. Love in the antique mall, graves unmarked. Kids Who Die is my subject, as it was Langston's. Men of many hues, an international tribe. Where lie the mothers in the plethora of lives? Hermione and H.D., fictive and real, in the snows of yesteryear, a Margareta and Gertrude, Suzanne of Martinique, Elena's Tina Madotti, Juna who roams the world in search of home and hope. My school of exile is a form of man and woman, adolescent intrusions, as this document shows, a common frailty among old men. The frothy brew of my exuberance leaves me nonplussed before the need to write and weave citation into my text. A habit of my Aunt Gladys, her silver curls, her mirror and brush of plated gold. Margaret asks how I survived our family life, our dad's cannibalistic rage. Exile from the mills was easy enough for me, first a coffin maker and then a professor. The dissident Thoreau is my contemporary. I hunted the condemned father, as was the case with Neil, the mark of Cain on my brow, more kin to Grendel than the hero. I wandered marshlands and botanized flesh-eating plants, sinkholes that swallowed cattle, my Irish bog, my mother's native land, Vovailis Du. That's an essay poem. Thank you. you get the little pun on. I just noticed this today somewhere in here. Well, there was a pun on Hughes. Kind of weird. So this is a lyrical, sort of like antiphonic lyrical to what you just heard. So in the book, it's sort of going to be double space instead of single space to mark off lyrical space. I don't know if my voice can do that. The boy held an owl in his eyes. The skin over the flat bridge of his nose freckled. He had no chin. With the passage of years, identity dissolves in the flat blue light that mesmerizes a proud house on the high street. Memory searches for his name, surprised at how easily it rejects so many before settling like a bird of prey on one. I wonder, too, about the becoming bird or animal in the life of the boy. Acrid flecks of tobacco, bitter on the lower lip, and the rowdy wrestling among the strong. I sat outside the ring watching the erotic display that displaces the anger that constricts the throat in the name of the father. In the loft, exposed beams provided nooks for pigeons to roost, bird shit bred worms that infected the mattress where we lay in our love making, his dick pressed against my anus. All around the barn now and along the fence line, a shocking display of forsythia ignites the very bowels of beauty. Joy is caught on the wing of this light. And yes, maybe too much nostalgia in these poems for the world before AIDS. This is continuing the Charlie Shively theme as much as it is a theme. The poem is called Philadelphia. Lost in Philly. It's also a poem that's sort of like a commentary on our republic in its current state. Philadelphia. Lost in Philly. Take me to the nearest middle school. Take me to a shoe store, towing my daughter by her hand. The minds of the assembled men turned toward Rome. They sought equality among themselves and their brothers. Equal rights, not justice for all, would be the subject of a delayed revolution whose time was yet to come. A people united will not be defeated, some said. Some died by firing squad, some in prisons. The prophet of corporations within a corporate body indemnified the golden rule. Profit outstrips arithmetic. The senatorial thing to do is to have your portrait taken in front of a bookcase. The aged poet resembled a mother superior. Lies, lies, roaches and flies, wrote Freddie Greenfield, dedicated to John Wiener's amusement business. Just think, Hemingway owned a Catlin farm. Each implement holds symbolic intent, axe, wagon, watering can. The eucalyptus of family lore contains all that is Spain, all that is not. Where is the art from Rio? Where the golden mortar and pestle? Picabi is woman with bulldogs hung in Stieglitz's gallery 291. Oily patina of sexualized nudes. Not nude at all, slathered with slippery oil. Not naked, not nude. Rebuff of magazine culture. But I like tabloids. So did Freddy. Carl Van Vechten's portrait of Joyce. Bryant, nudes for gay white men, proliferate Manhattan, mourn the dead cavalry horses that carpet the prairie, wind-tossed long grass, legs and manes aligned with the northeasterly flow, gouts of blood where arrows pierce the American flag in tatters, 1881, from a photographic account of the Battle of Little Bighorn. Did the assembled men apprehend future truths of mutilation? Yankee Doodle Dandy, stuff a cock in a cock hat, drive me to the next whiskey bar, lackey with the plume cockade, shades of Alabama song, the age of privilege and decadence has just begun. The poet is a nun. Socrates spoke, the particular doesn't warrant the universal. Only to beauty has it been allowed to be most manifest. Phaedrus, the bon vivant who likes a beast, who like a beast proceeds to lust and procreation, venerates the monad of lyric poetry. The non-identity of concept to material undoes symbolic order by magnification of the radical particular. The new narrative strips bare ancient bargains, topples the soul from his throne atop the pyramid. With aberrant, irrational lines, I lift my skirts and from the mud, up from the mud, and fumble my way through the gap known as Crotched Mountain. With new shoes, she cartwheels through the zodiac. Visible joy, if neighbors would douse their lights. Thank you. I'll try to read a smaller one, and then I know one more I wanted to conclude with. Some of these essay poems are 23 stanzas long, so it gets quite interesting. All right, I'll read a long one. Or maybe I'll read a short one, then the long one. One of the things I've been thinking about in doing this, as I said about my other book, is Paul Celan. And Paul Celan's last address said that poetry originated with an ape or an automaton and a third choice. I forget. I'm not a great scholar. So this is a short poem without a title. My instinct lay with the automaton, not the ape, not the age. She came on like a river run. Her limbs fused, descending stairs. She chats, and she chats. She is our mother, mother of us all. Phonemes today, in their discourse, contaminate one another. Stars spangle the night sky. So is the American pastoral, set in now foreclosed Grover's Corners, anywhere, USA. The prayers of the Republic, swathed in Gothic melancholy. So was time before the wars. So was time before Vietnam. Not for the first time boys and girls lay down in different lands, far from home, places that can no longer be found. A meridian that is the site of a conversation. Poetry must, like philosophy, speak with its other. Now, another essay poem, if you'll allow me. Contradictory sentences. Well, I'll tell you how this poem came together. It blends three concepts. One was reading a young man, my age, I guess, we were both young poets, Andrew Levy. And another was listening to Alice Notley read recently from her new work. And the other was the death of Juan Goytisolo. Juan Goytisolo is a Spanish novelist whose greatest love and inspiration was Jean Genet. And I would link Goytisolo, Genet, and Shively in my subtext about liberation as opposed to equality. Contradictory sentences form series of indeterminate length. energy arises in bending the line. Abrupt carriage returns, word substitutions, staging motivates scaled unfoldings. When you look at the field work, you see the problem of agency supported by the sophistication of upward mobility. A contrapuntal structure moves among several different lives. A cue to the method of writing, the world order under capitalism. The method generates incongruities in the field of action. Meaning is in play, quote, an abyss of crop duster dictums, writes Andrew Levy, Artifice in the Calm Damages, the chapbook from which I have been quoting. He continues, revolutionaries via minor roots, filth, blood, and noise. His text is in the key of anarchy. No newly born utopia looms on the far horizon of destruction. Alice Notley, in turn, writes in the key of really pissed off. Most of us are slaves, largely by consent, or you could say we're brainwashed. She's sardonic. I work in a shelter for battered women. I submitted to a pharaonic circumcision. Facing the abyss of embodied affect, paralyzed, I see a cat sprawled under the clothes tree. Juan Goytisolo, Muere en Marrakech, City of High Life Nightmare, Juju Music, Jema Elfna, Central Square of Dance Parties and All Night Food Stalls, estranged from myself, grizzled old man in a brilliant Berber jacket. Goytisolo sat with his back to the wall, mint tea, a notebook for recording phrases from an Arabic that has no alphabet, seeking to better understand those with whom he shared his exile, three adopted children and their mother. The tide that surrounds us grows impatient with lame foot measures. He chose the Atlantic shore at La Roche for his internment. He eschewed literary prizes. From the need to educate his children, he accepted the Cervantes, crippled as he was and unable to stand on his legs. Now he lies with Jean Genet as he had wanted. Exile is central to my disposition. Abjection, docility, and submissiveness, threaded as they are with anger, inform the only poetry any of us write. Remember Alice's magic. Is it possible to be an American in an age of deception? What, that's motive for exile in hers, in my case. In Andrew's, what does he do? He is pushed toward the book. He begins with a conclusion. Nothing is here. Title and first line of an earlier composition. By that he means all that once had embodied joy is now absent. Such desolation. Humor doesn't help. Quote, the vile stench makes sunbathing impossible and swimming through the slime. The tiny trapped sea creatures living inside perish when the algae hit the beach, creating a putrid, sulfurous stench, end quote. Is there a resolution to, quote, the chaos of dreaming life, quote, where poetry is wed with pain? Alice writes, I wish you'd waterboard me, make my heart crash. We're immortal. It hurt my throat. What a bunch of liars they are. She has no interest in being myself. I just am. She forces the poet's hand. There's nothing here now. There's only me. She has no answer to hovering incompleteness. It isn't a good price that you pay for writing a poem, she said. Everyone I know has money for their daily needs, even more than they know they have. to them within the confines of their reality. There's no imaginable alternative to their security and comfort. This insight came to me during a heat wave. Even for my kids, there's nothing to be done but to call the installer. Quote, I tried to learn how to be a person, Alice wrote. In depth, we speak. In dreams, we speak. And in the immaterial past and future, our vocal cords are fast as birds. End quote. She clutches a grail of light to her chest and gives it to a child. So, too, thought those in honor of Goytisolo as his bark rode the waves. He no longer had words for his life. Andrew concludes, these are my words. Nobody asked me to write them. As to the riddle of this essay poem, he suggests, you could identify with the poor. That's the key of one's attempt to decode the analphabetism of the crowded square. These don't have titles. Wrapped in folds of uncertainty, the prospect of affection caused Boethius to tremble. Impossible to be so naked. He hugged his knees. Last poem. A limpet attaches herself to my heart. Hopefully she won't metastasize. Yes, Robert Frost is a great poet, but each wins love for different reasons. That damn limpet gnaws. To win, to earn, to fall. Very illogical. Vallejo's widowed wine bottle. My daughter calls it sleep training, steeling yourself not to run when the baby cries. I'd like to say yes. It's only a matter of unpleasant odors, viscous fluids, but because of the limpet, I shrink into myself. That calcined creature will not let loose.
Michael Franco is a playwright, poet, and artist. He has been a contributing editor for Lift magazine and a member of the poetry panel for Agni magazine. For 10 years, he directed the word-of-mouth reading series in Cambridge. In the fall of 2016, he inaugurated a new series, Exit, or Shit the Bear, in the press room. He is the living legend of Upper Oxford Street, Michael Franco.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here before you. I will be reading from the recently published A Book of Measure that Dear Ed Foster at Talisman put out the first volume of. I've been working on this thing since fall of 1991. It's now, the first two volumes are complete. Ed published the first volume, and I have foolishly started a third volume. I don't want to say a lot about it. The whole idea of the book was to allow anything to happen, which seemed like a brilliant idea when I first proposed it, until I realized very quickly how narrow-minded I was. I kept saying, well, that doesn't belong here, this doesn't belong here, this doesn't belong here. But I wanted a field. I knew that. I wanted a landscape, which is what I sort of drew out of the Duncan Olson idea of field. But what really put a fingerprint on my brain back when I was in my 20s, I went to a lecture that Duncan did on Olson at Berkeley. And he was, I would love to find this letter. I hope it's coming out in those letters. He claimed that he had immediately written Olson when Olson proposed having an open verse and said, but Charles, of course, if it's really open, it has to be closed too. To which he got some horrifying blast back, you know, like, don't screw up the system. But that stuck to me, and I loved that idea. And so I proceeded on with this. And so it's basically, it's a landscape of narratives, though. All sorts of different things. I wanted any form to be able to come in. There are many kinds of rhymes. There's sound rhymes, image rhymes, and narrative rhymes working through it. And there is a central narrator who will pop up here in the beginning of my reading. He comes and goes, as does the voice that is describing him. Okay, and I'm happy for questions when we're done, but that's all I want to tell you, because my fantasy was that the reader would be inside of this field. The real thing with field that I took away was the image of, we're not going to cut a path across the field and then turn around as some of the Frostian poets might do and say, look at what I found here. Isn't it amazing? Look at this. It's like this, right? And instead, that you place the reader and yourself in a field of ongoing activity that is emerging and receding around you constantly. So you can't know, which to me, in my hubris, struck me as being closer to what life might be actually like, instead of the normally. I grew up reading Thomas Mann, and I had that image, you know, every single period and comma in the form working until and honed until it all made perfect sense, top to bottom. So I will begin at the beginning. There's the book. The book is laid out in circumferences instead of chapters. The first circumference has no number. And I'll just proceed from there. This is the opening. We enter again, gain or regain or lose our own madness. Lame words to rely so close upon. We wake up, come down from dream. Thee to name intimacy rests close to the bone-locked arbitrator I name here habit. We cannot rest. Reality is frame. The picture moves against its own central habit of relocation. Everything is footnote to a syllabic DOS. There will not be enough memory. Improper shutdown will result in loss which cannot be defined. Loss relates habit, facilitates search. Life shuffles through accumulations, old papers stuck together, layers of sedimentary vanity, vain moves, finger run up into air. To recall original direction is to lose original direction. Cock twirling at the end of metal pole, squeak caw challenge to circular habits repeated in the face of imminent storm, never, not once, not even a little successful. Forestalling the inevitable. Rain starts, strong, with repeated hesitation, gains a certain control through intensity, ends. Rivers of accumulation carry glass-eyed city, rainbow of oil slick and twisted toward storm drain, runoff catch basin of would-be seascape by intentionless painter who, finding no movement, was condemned to paint tides. Accumulated rain on upper surface of leaves brushed by wind scatters showers without apparent announcement. The story emerges and we enter. We enter and the story emerges. So memory then is stitched, an overtone threading between habit and loss, a thief working the locks of the essential door, maddening the scratching sound, lingering beneath conversation, beneath sleep, beneath falling in love. The extreme of mixed metaphors. Memory, never above nature, always measuring. Hear it? Always measuring. Biology eats at the stitches, a divine corruption of intention that lingers until a snap is not heard. Unannounced occurrences are history. History is stitched. A child playing at the boundary of an adulthood marvels at the knot, picks at it. Wondrous dexterity is tradition. Growth, not progress, but the assumption of assumptions, measure to measure added. Not if, but how. If not if, then how. Simple math made complex by the addition of numbers. Population, control, birth, all habit. Thin skin of life stretched over resounding eternal drum. Each tide as it rises or recedes, a knot in the conception of what is taken to mean, hand notice from periphery of attention, negative capability, always wondering what was taken, what will be missed, of what was alluded to that is attempting to run against the line of the ocean's rising light trail of foam wavering over foundation of sand is emerging history. Feet wet, crouching, he dipped his hand into the water and brought the ocean to his nose. Deep breath of salt. Return to studio. When everything listens, who will sing? When everything sings, rain will come again. The forest will return to its place. Houses will fall. Air will clear. Companies of small, quick-colored birds will rise up from deep green, turn and approach us again. We will know. We will hear. We will know enough not to speak. He kept a plate of bees in his kitchen. Simply, he said, because he liked it. It was extraordinary, a large plate, clear glass, with gentle, possibly gracefully sloping sides, covered completely with bees, all of them moving, constantly moving, each one of them plump, yellow, and distinguished. Each morning he took the glass plate of bees down from the high shelf of an old glass-doored white china cabinet where the bees spent the night and placed it on a thick wooden counter that, while out of the way, was still quite visible. They would busily depart and return, as bees are apt to do. This gave to the room a soft, delicate hum and particular musky smell, and each evening he would return them carefully, carrying the clear glass plate across the kitchen before he quietly slipped it onto its shelf for the night. He did this each night, at or around dusk, or before company would arrive, so that the bees would be well out of the way, and yet, in doing so, he would always leave the door slightly ajar so that they could have a little air, I suppose, allowing a few of them to continue to make circumnavigations of the room, which then extended their curious presence into the evening. The net effect of all this, especially in the summer, at the end of a hot day, when, with the light lingering as it does, without shadows, stripped of its heat, I would sit, settled into one of the overstuffed chairs of his living room, surrounded by plants and all but overwhelmed by the deep smell of the dark coffees that he constantly brewed in a large glass Meliora infuser, which he would slowly plunge, quietly causing the light brown water to turn by some alchemy of his hand a redolent mahogany. Was a feeling of being overwhelmed, slightly annoyed, slightly curious, overcome, a feeling not unlike that of being held when you're not absolutely sure that you want to be. Returning from the little kitchen where the bees were kept, where he disappeared throughout the evening into a whirl of kettle whistles and grinder noises, always returning within moments, it seemed certainly not long enough to complete these preparations with a plate of always strange cookies, which would be neatly, if not geometrically, arranged and then rearranged each time anyone dared extract one from the plate. The result, of course, being that if I actually dared to remove one, which I was, in repeated counterpoint to this seemingly impenetrable geometric prison that they were held within, constantly urged to do, the process of figuring out which of the cookies, when removed, would inflict the least chaos would take quite some time, as I would quietly and not without some measure of silent panic bring to bear all of my analytic power fueled by the immeasurable desire for chocolate. The sense of joy mixed with that of accomplishment at having actually achieved this near impossible goal, which was indicated by his merely, almost absent-mindedly flicking the offending cookie back into its proper position at the end of his cocked finger, nearly equaled the pleasure, now finally grasped, so to speak, of the taste of the little cookie itself. The net effect, then, was of being suspended in this constantly mutable arrangement of which I was now a participating part, settled as I was into this enfolding chair. I dipped. We all dipped. The coffee was that good, almost thick, the added decadence of the chocolate causing almost perceptible smiles on anyone present, no matter how often the experience was repeated. To just sit there together, whether alone or with his other friends, either talking or in complete silence, sound of a bee hum off in the near distance. And then somewhere in working with the book, I kept saying that I was living with all of the elements and people, and there were books constantly being referred to by those people. And at some point, those books started to be read by the central narrator. And this is from an article that he was reading that he actually later finds the entire book. But it is an article on a man named Smiths who wrote a book about the Pelipet. And he wrote a book about the Pelipet. And this is the journal that this article is in. It's a journal of anthropological studies published by University of Chicago, 1968. And it's titled Random Notes on the Daily Lives of the Pelipet and Mr. Smiths. And one note, and that is that the word Oklaboro, it begins all Pelipet stories. And it means the other time, past in present, present in past. And this story is titled The Legend of the Six, and again, this is collected by Smiths. The Legend of the Six Five-Toed Tree Frogs, Pelipet, 300 to 600 years old. The record is oral. The title is technically Kilikut Kilobro Kiloro. The teller is Kilikut Pelipet, also called Ashkaboka, or Who Possesses the Story of Ourselves. Oklaboro, 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 and with his many tellings. There was once, at the edge of the great Kilobo forest, Kilobo meaning naked or one who strips, a leafless tree, as were all trees in the Boca, where lived 6 5-toed tree frogs, each of whom had control over a given set of branches where they were in great competition for the various insects that would come within their reach and their tongues. One morning, the third of the six ate particularly well, and whilst laying in the sun on his leafless branch, drifted off into sleep, where he began to dream. In the dream, he could dance, which he did, with grand effect, moving from branch to branch, like the Kalinda dancers in the Humpwa. 4 of the remaining 5 watched, moved beyond frog speech to utter nothing more than guttural croaks to the air and the performance. The fifth of the remaining 4, originally the 6th of the 6, turned and slept as the 3rd of the 6 danced and leapt to the chorus of the others. The 3rd awoke and discovered that of the 6, there were now but 5. A week or so later, as the sun rose carrying the blossom air with it, the 3rd again found himself heavy with sleep and was soon lost in dream. In this dream, he spoke with eloquence the language of the sea. He had only to open his mouth, and the great whoosh of the ocean as it met the sand would come pouring forth from him. 3 of the remaining 4 heard this and sat upon their branches in amazement. The 6th, not 5th, slept in silence upon his branch. When the 3rd awoke, there were but 3 of the 6 that had become 5. He now grew alarmed. He ceased to roam his branch or defend his frogdom as he had in the past. Nothing seemed of importance, not even food. He feared sleep. Gnats landed on his head without peril. He refused the seduction of sleep, held it off day after day until he could no longer do so. Near dusk of the 3rd day, he began to slip into sleep like a man slips into a still pool. The sound of the ocean returned to him again and became his voice, and he longed, like a lover, to be one with the ocean that was now the feeling within him, dreaming. He felt wet, then dry, hot, then cool as the night air. But he caught himself, forced sleep away, and yet awoke at the end of his branch, bobbing gently up and down. He looked about the tree for the 3, only to find that of the 6 that had become 3, there were now but 2. The 6th, now the 3rd, sat in the crook of the branch, sleeping. Days passed as before, his thoughts filled with fear, his longing filled with thoughts of the ocean. At length he slept against his will, in obedience to his longing. He sat asleep on the branch in dream until he began to feel loose, and the sound of the ocean filled him more and more, until he slowly, like a trickle of water across the expanse of the great leaf, began to turn to sand and pour down onto the bare stone of the forest floor, filling it as he did. This, the remaining two of the six watched. The silence of the forest looked down. On the seventh day, following the disappearance of the third, the sixth, who was now the second, watched a magnificent blue dragonfly dart amongst the bare branches of the tree. As he did, he found himself filled with a longing to fly. He moved to the far end of his branch, clutching most precariously the tenderest tips of the wood, the silent air, bobbing the branch with its movement. In an instant, the dragonfly flew within reach, and the frog, without thought, snatched him from the air. In a breath, the dragonfly was swallowed up. The sixth sat motionless and soon fell into sleep. In sleep, he began to dream that he, like the dragonfly, could fly. He turned and darted amongst all the trees at will, and it was a wonderful feeling to be so free and to move upon the air. When he awoke, the other was gone, and the dream would not release him. The sixth, who was now the first, ached to fly. He returned to sleep like the Ashkenboka to follow the dream, but found, when he did, only sleep. Day upon day, night upon night, he longed to dream that he might know the air again, yet the dream would not return. He did not eat, and finally he could no longer sleep, as the disappointment of doing so without dream was more than he could bear. At last, he crawled to the highest tip of the longest branch and leaned farther, ever farther out, until he held on with no more than his legs, and here he at last fell into sleep. As he slept, still perched at the tip of the branch, the Kalobo tree awoke from her long sleep, which is time itself, and opened herself and began to draw him, the sixth, who was now the first, little by little into the branch. But the sixth held firm, bobbing at the far extent of branch and legs. The great Kalobo continued little by little to swallow him up, but the frog stretched out his forelegs and resisted with all his frogness her attempts. There he stayed like a small green statue until sleep caught him blinking, and soon he was no longer a frog, but part tree, part green, and in time he was what we now call a leaf. Time passed, leaving behind days and nights, and with each new day another leaf was formed, until where what had once and always been but bare branches was now deep green leaves moving at the ends of delicate stems. Now the silent wind blew, moving across the leaves, which danced and twirled in their place. The voice of the ocean was released to fill the air with her song. The trail of days became months. One morning, in the cool of the cooling air, a single leaf slipped into sleep and began to dream of flying. Upon waking, he at once let go of the branch and fluttered on the air toward the sandy ground below, and in time was followed by all the rest, the sand below opening its dry longing to take each and all of them into itself. The bare trees looked down, and soon they too fell into sleep. And so time. This boka, Smiths concluded, never ceases to remind me of the little song that Merat, daughter of Sinkus, sang. I know why the trees dance, tell me. I know why the trees sing, tell me. I know why the leaves fall, tell me. And I know why the frog hides, tell me. Tell me, tell me, and I'll dream for you. Smith records that he has never understood the implications of this story, but began to find himself uncomfortable walking into the forest alone, and eventually gave up entirely his habit of taking lunch to the great tree, where, having eaten, he would read and nap a bit in what had been a sweet respite from his studies. And then I'll... close here with a section from late in the second volume. This is out in the eighth circumference. I think of these sections that are like this as lyric bridges to the other narratives that are working in the book. Life spin to reason, seasoned and rendered down to surrender. Let loose again as so often, my chair, my cup, my certain view, set and then reset, lost foothold, gained again and again, again. All rivers run and oceans roar above the silent sand. I take my share in rooms and even the hint of the same. Last leaf falling, bare earth, bless thy graceful instruments and liberty and life. Springs up and down, calling back on frozen lines, aches into being, raising the sun on golden arms set on pure remembrance, blooming out of the dark on stalks of circumstance. Along the road to spring and just outside, the season set and late to brilliance, I am a traveler of no more than the day's horizon set on and voracious toward what notice I can if I have the strength to take. Yet at evening, at the end of the long day when all the light is finally present and the shadows that seemed so previously recent are not long, are claiming but soften the edges of each leaf, each rude rill of bark or spiral round of grand and soaring growth laid out and generous in the height above me, bird flight left and right and the proper smell of laurel and dirt that waits for fog or rain in the same time between the wind that busies itself in its surging near to cat-like fetch that falls away to silence before letting go. From this, then, all things, myself likewise, flow. In the moments of excellence, and indeed there are moments, hastily gather in a forward-moving dimensional tranquility and look up. Relevance seams itself into a hole out of which narrative emerges, moving just shy of what actually happened. Before it overflows itself and pours out into history, which is memory. And memory is perhaps no more than time, which like a smooth surface with a little dust blown homes-like across it will relinquish a fingerprint indication of what was there, which, retrieved without regard, can savage a morning with thoughts of what is not. As today, it is both my father and mother who gave me both time and memory to recall from the aroma of a morning fire or the simple fetch of heated air emerging from floor grates in the small hours of morning to relax the taut night air with warmth or the fine clamor of a crowded table at dinner, first dinners, home at my grandmother's, aunts and uncles, teasing cousins everywhere and a simple chicken with a simpler risotto, sourdough, and if I was lucky, a Coke. And my father, sitting on the blue wood box seat next to me, his then great arm around me, always I remember asking if I had gotten enough to eat. In the happiness that must have been my grandmother's to have all of this swirling beneath her as she moved from the still when I was small wood-fired stove to sink to table and back, brooding over what was more normally a quiet and empty room. I return to this now. Stunned quietly and without drama, but stunned by its complete and absolute absence. Begin then in absolute absence. This the true number line sequence we follow. Call it counting, call it called to account, the four directions circle and return to themselves. I count the days I left to others whose own lives never missed the steps of the counts I left behind. A dancer standing aside to move again, always, always away and near even as they quietly move on. This dance of numbers does not stop for counting. Each sequence completes in going on then in completion. I went on as well. This, though in time, is hard to see. My thought, my daily life, always including my thoughts of those I left, as indeed it still does only now, tempered by my too often lack of existence in the lives of those in the other time. More often than not, it was as if some movie self could return to see the memory of what its life in death had left. The odd ramble away from all that had been common, the spiraling up, up, up of a life thread until extent is cleared and the long fall to earth begins. So many lives attempting to clear the horizon of mortality. So many diversions and abrupt and mute ends. California, Rhode Island, Texas, Virginia, California, Florida, Arizona, California, all float at random around my thought, each filled with sets of characters, all acting out the lives I project them to have, all in amber circling. Doris wanting to write, Chris practicing his guitar, all waiting to begin where in truth we have all we all are what we are and will be. When there is no longer when I, the true circling begins. So then, star, whose light is no longer there, shines on brightly, quite insane. Shine on, instructs that what in fact is not there is indeed there as well. So then, so shoo. What surrounds us, what holds us up, is not there and always is respectfully. A line of poetry, any less so, floats up as a leaf in fall, rises to reveal and revel in its opposite, calls out into the air of all the possible paths of address. So then, so Shu, who always and ever present holds in delicate eternity the very air we take in. So starlight is memory, and each night as I walk. And what frosts in the sea is not a concern, more foam than waves, calls out for ornament, and I cull memory, who is my mother, and whose song is the swell that rocks our lives, mere ornament indeed, my life, my thought, my chair, old man, and there is nothing can truly ornament remembrance. Who judge? Time and tides and leaves and air, seasons of days and seasons, fingerprint remnant. And for each a position, a place from which to take note, take heart, take flight, and in terror soar toward what in the end is the only common comfort in sharing the obvious. We will step each step a dance of occurrence, each occurrence accumulates to being. I take perhaps silly pleasure in what I hear or feel of the reach into all of this. Martha Graham or Isadora Duncan reaching, extending a hand into empty air. Occupation, place, gesture of search or longing or just not knowing, but in deep need and from deeper pleasure, simple gifts. A hand will slip into yours, she said, and I laughed, and then it did. And now remembering, I am bent toward more to then remember, as the compass needle will swing and come true. My heart, my eyes will find you, will smile and nod at everything that has happened and that has not, and in doing so, live. Thank you. Amanda, Henry, thank you.
We need to have some questions. I want to just show one thing. I wish I had the book. This is the cover of the essay poems when it comes out. Mm-hmm. That's a Taino frog star emblem.
A Taino what?
Emblem of a frog or a sun. Taino being the Native Americans that were exterminated by the Spanish who came to Cuba. Maybe you'll see it on the internet and you say, oh yeah.